So, hi Peter, could you introduce yourself and tell me a bit about your background, where you're from, and things about your family?
Yes, thank you, Debs. My name's Peter Dorr. I've lived in Walthamstow since 1970, and I was a GLC member for the neighbouring constituency of Leighton from 1981 to 86. At the time of being a GLC member, I was a full-time teacher in a comprehensive school in Chingford, which is in the north of Waltham Forest. I'd previously fought two general election campaigns for Labour. I went home to my West Country area of West Dorset to fight the October 74 election, and then in 1979 I'd fought Chipping Barnet. I come from a West Country Methodist background. I'm a lay preacher of that church and still am, and indeed I started my public speaking in the Tolpuddle Church itself, where of course the martyrs came from, although the building is a later one, the one they built.
So it sounds like religion and politics were part of your upbringing.
Yes, very much so. My dad was a Methodist local preacher and was a very active member of the National Union of Teachers. He was a head teacher in Dorchester of the Secondary Modern School. So that's the background I come from.
And what was your education like? What sort of schools did you go to?
I was actually born in Luton in Bedfordshire and went to an infant school there. And for the last two terms of infant school, my dad got his second headship in Dorset, so I went to local state schools. The secondary school I went to had once been a public school, but it was a VA grammar. And then I came to London to read medieval and modern history at UCL and followed that with a PGCE at the Institute of Education.
So that's the point that you came to London to study?
Yes, I came in October 66 to study at UCL.
And what was that like, moving to London?
It's something I wanted to do. I mean, I was far from unfamiliar with London from day trips, and it was the time to be in London, wasn't it? 66 onwards, swinging London, and at the same time it was really good to be taught by some of the world's leading historians in their period. It was a great time, and I think it's one of the highlights of my life.
And what else was happening for you in your life in the kind of 70s and 80s, in the period running up to
that? Well, the main thing of course is I met my wife Janet at church in 1971, and I married her a year later and had two children, Martin, who was born in 1975, and our daughter Elizabeth, who was born in 1980. So I had an ordinary family life and an ordinary job as a teacher. It was a great place. London is always a great place to live, and I think institutions like the GLC have helped to make it so.
And what schools were you teaching in at the time?
I started teaching in St George Monarchs when it was a 14 to 18 boys comprehensive. It had previously been a leading London grammar school. Then I went on to become head of year in Chingford in the north of the borough, and then I returned to St George Monarchs just after the GLC went in 1988. It had then become a mixed sixth form college. It was very multicultural.
And whereabouts were you living in London?
I've always lived in Walthamstow. I was in Diggs for the first few years till we married. Then we lived near Black Horse Road station, and now, and from December 76 in fact, we live very near Wood Street station on the Chingford main line branch.
And what do you like about that area of London?
It's an odd thing to say. It's very easy to go into London and very easy to go out of London. We have the railway to Liverpool Street, 5 minutes walk from home. We can go onto the motorway network, the M11, 5 minutes drive from home. So it's a very good place to get in and out of. And of course we have all the benefits of Epping Forest literally on our doorstep.
And in terms of politics, so you talked a bit about there being kind of politics in your family growing up. How did you feel about politics when you were a young person?
I can't remember ever being other than Labour, or my father other than being Labour, with one exception, when he voted tactically to the Liberals in February 74, to which there was only one answer by my standing as a Labour candidate in October, the second election of that year. I joined the Labour Party in July 67. I was working in a part-time job in the County Hall in Dorchester, Dorset County Council, and several of my temporary colleagues there were going to the Tolpuddle Martyrs rally, so I went with them and they asked me would I like to join the Labour Party, and I joined then and remained ever since. It's almost 50 years now.
And what other things? So you were involved in the Labour Party, or were you also involved in unions, like your father?
Not to the same extent. I've always been a member of the NUT. I was involved before I went on the GLC on the Community Health Council and the Community Relations Council in Waltham Forest, and I've also been very active as a Methodist lay preacher. I celebrate 50 years of that next year in 2018.
And were there any particular people that inspired you in your politics, how you understood things?
Yes, indeed. Obviously, with my Methodist background, Donald Soper comes to mind. And with our family connections with East Cornwall, the Foote family, both Isaac and Michael, they were inspirations.
What was it about them that inspired you?
Very much the way in which they use the political system to challenge injustice, putting forward a rational case. And obviously there's the Methodist connection as well, with both of them.
So you were in London in the late 60s and 70s.
Yes.
And you were, what was it like being part of the Labour Party in London at that time?
I wasn't active in the party in London until I started working in the autumn of 1970. It's the old story, you go along to the Labour Party branch meeting and a month later you end up Ward Secretary, at least that's what happened to me. At the time, Labour had very few local authorities under its control in 1970, and there was a lot of excitement of winning Waltham Forest back in 1971, which has been Labour held, I believe, with only two exceptions ever since.
So, what was the party, local party like?
It was a very mixed party in the sense that you had people who'd been in it all their lives, and you had younger, mainly professional people like myself, who were moving into the area. Many of us were in the public sector. All of us were very committed to racial justice and extending educational opportunity.
And so, obviously, the 1970s has a lot of turbulence. And at the end of the 1970s, Thatcher won. What are your memories of that period and of Thatcher coming in?
Insofar as there was turbulence inside the Labour Party, Waltham Forest was largely spared that. There was, to some extent, a generational struggle. I suppose there always will be, between the younger and more radical members and the older members at the time. Regarding race relations, Waltham Forest has never had the urban troubles which affected other parts of London twice in the 80s and more recently in 2011. I'd put that down to the fact that there's been relatively little far-right organisation, except they did try in 74 under the name of Waltham Forest Residents Association, who were really the National Front. But apart from a very, very high vote in the GLC elections of 77, they didn't make much impact. Similarly, the Borough Council, in its quiet way, had did a lot through what was then called the West Indian Supplementary Service to actually bring the needs and understanding of a multicultural community into policy making.
So So that's very interesting. So the National Front was using a kind of front organisation.
Yes, that has been well documented by Martin Walker in his book. I'm not sure if it's still available, simply called The National Front. They fought wards mainly in Walthamstow and Leighton, and that I know for a fact that one of my neighbours was induced to be a candidate, and the most pleasant man otherwise. They obviously were conning a lot of people, but it did force the Labour Party in Waltham Forest to look at its organisation, and that is why I believe we won back the Leighton seat, which the Tories had won in 1977 by 191 votes. And with the work of help of my colleagues, we were able to turn that into a Labour majority of under 7,000 in 1981. Similarly, Labour held on very well, and I believe lost only one ward in the 1978 elections. Going back to your original question about Thatcher, of course I fought the neighbouring seat to her. She fought Finchley, I fought Chipping Barnet in the borough of Barnet in 79. I think that Thatcher was appealing to very basic instincts which cost Labour votes. For example, the sale of council housing and the promise to avoid us being, quote, swamped by immigrants. That did make an impact. But again, Waltham Forest, we did hold on to the Walthamstow seat, which was only lost briefly in the 87 election until Neil Gerrard regained it in 1992 for us.
And what did it feel like? What was the reaction? Do you remember the night that she was elected? I guess you were waiting for your own results.
Yes, indeed. As we were going in for our count in Hendon Town Hall, all the camera crews were leaving. Yes, I do remember that night.
And what was the feeling like amongst you and the people you were with?
We were pleased to hold on to a clear second place in Chipping Barnet, but obviously we were disappointed with the overall result. It hadn't been helped, of course, by the winter of discontent which had preceded the election. Had we gone in the autumn of 78, my own reckoning would be that we might very well have had a hung parliament, which was better than we got in May 79.
And so tell me about that period. So Thatcher and the Conservatives win in 79.
Yes.
And then you end up becoming a GLC councillor in 81.
That's right.
And what happened in those 2 years? Do you remember things?
Yes, indeed. I was applying for further promotion in teaching. I'd had several interviews where I was runner-up, and I can tell you exactly how I became a GLC councillor. It was in January 1981. The election, of course, was to be held at the beginning of May of that year. The candidate for Leighton had withdrawn from the candidacy, and I had a phone call one evening saying, please give your reply in 48 hours whether you want your name to go forward. Because I was well known at that time in Labour Party circles in Waltham Forest, as I had been the vice chair of the local government committee in the mid-70s, which oversaw the selection of candidates for the 1978 election. I thought about it, put my hat in the ring, and of the six people shortlisted, I was lucky enough to be the person elected by the party members.
And at this point you had a full-time job?
As I did right through until the late 90s, where I took voluntary redundancy. Unfortunately, when I'd finished my master's, which was part of the redundancy deal, I had a cardiac arrest, survived, but took early retirement from the teaching profession. Though I have had a part-time job since then, in the early 2000s.
But this must have been a busy time in the early 80s.
Oh, it was ridiculously busy. I would be teaching until lunchtime, and then perhaps four afternoons a week I would drive straight up to County Hall for a committee meeting or a full council meeting. The full council meetings went on to quite late at night. But one thing about County Hall was there were excellent refreshment facilities, so one could have a meal there.
And what about the build-up to that election in May 1981 and Labour winning control?
Very busy time. I mean, I was an experienced candidate. As I said, I'd fought two parliamentary elections by then. I also knew the local press from my involvement in the local community with other organisations. So I did a lot of canvassing and a lot of press statements to the local papers, most of which were taken up. But it was really due to the enthusiasm of the members in Leighton, who were absolutely shocked that an East End seat could be lost to the Tories in 1977. So a busy and enjoyable time.
And then Labour won.
Yes.
And there was obviously... could you describe that kind of initial process that Ken ended up taking?
Tremendous excitement at the count. I mean, we went from a small Tory majority to a massive Labour one. I can remember going up to the group meeting, and a group of us who wanted Ken in met in the committee room beforehand to choose a slate of candidates, many of whom were not known to me, as of course I've been involved far more either where I was parliamentary candidate or in Waltham Forest rather than London-wide. And yes, it was a very exciting time, indeed.
And can you remember, I know a little bit about that process by which Ken did become leader.
Yes.
What do you remember about it?
Well, I remember being approached by him on the telephone, and I thought, well, this is the time for a new generation to come forward. And many of us then were in our 30s, or indeed some people in their 20s, and they went on to take office. And the rest, as they say, is history.
And what is it that you found exciting about Ken?
I think Ken is very dedicated, and still is, to the service of London. I found him very witty. I've always found him extremely personable.
And I can't remember the name of the person that he replaced.
His name was Andrew McIntosh, later Lord McIntosh.
So what was in the contrast between Andrew McIntosh and Ken?
It's a contrast of the old and the new. Andrew represented a sort of Fabian social democrat approach. And Ken, the group of us were very diverse, were broadly on the left, from the Tribunite group, including myself, to people to the left of that.
In terms of the GLC before Labour took control in 81, what did you know about the GLC and what did you think of it?
I knew a lot about it. I thought the Labour administration of 73 to 77 had achieved a lot, particularly in transport, with the bringing in of concessionary fares, which then and now are broader than in other parts of the country. We had an excellent GLC councillor in Walthamstow, in Robin Young, who was also a Haringey councillor, and he was there for 8 years, and he gave us very informative reports at every general committee once a month of what he was doing at County Hall. Regarding the Tory years, with the housing crisis in London, I was absolutely shocked that only 35 houses were built, council houses, in the year before the election. It seemed to be completely out of touch with London needs.
And you've talked a bit about London being an exciting time from 1966 when you arrived. What sort of things were happening in London and in those social movements? Which things excited you?
I think a lot of groups were forming, particularly in the ethnic minorities in our own borough, and it was really good to work with them, particularly when I was elected and then able to get them grants to support them in their work. I think of the Indian Muslim Federation, of various other groups like that whom we were able to support.
So tell me about the the committees you got involved in and how that happened?
Well, we were asked on which committees we could serve, and I chose, obviously, the Ethnic Minorities Committee. I believe we were the first local authority in the country to have one. I was very much involved in what was then styled race relations work in my own borough and in my own church as well. The other committee, main committee I was on, was the Transport Committee. I must confess to being a lifelong transport enthusiast, and I was very much at home there, and it was really exciting to bring in the Fares Fair scheme, the zonal fares on the underground and buses, the overnight lorry ban, and many other causes dear to my heart. I also served from the beginning on the Lee Valley Regional Park Authority, where the GLC put up the majority of the money, but did not have a numerical majority on the members, and that was very good as well. We managed to be involved in the environmental movement, particularly to save Walthamstow marshes from gravel extraction, and I worked very carefully, closely and carefully, with a Hackney-based group led by John and Jane Nash of the Save the Marshes campaign. We also saved the Leighton marshes, and it's really good now to walk down the Lee Valley and see it as a fantastic nature reserve, and the alternative would have been horrendous, of lorries going in and out all day. I did also chair for 2.5 years the Race and Housing Action Group in Tower Hamlets. This was a group of myself, GLC officers and representatives of different communities in Tower Hamlets. There's a story behind this one. The GLC's predecessor, the LCC, had built council houses before London boroughs in any form existed. There was inter-party agreement, I believe, that in the 70s and 80s these should be transferred to the borough councils. Tower Hamlets was the only borough where I believe we had housing when elected in 81. We worked with the Tower Hamlets on a joint management committee, but this did not work. It's my judgment, looking back as one can and at the time, that there was institutional racism in the provision of housing, and some of the views expressed to me outside of the meeting by Tower Hamlets councillors, Labour councillors indeed, pointed in that direction. So the decision was made, presumably by the policy committee at GLC, that we resume control of our housing until it was handed over in 1985, as it had to be, and that we had set precedents by ensuring that the voices and the aspirations of the local community, particularly the Sylheti Bengali community, were heard. And it was a great experience working with those communities to actually ensure that their needs were looked at in the provision of housing, from everything from the size of housing to the qualities which would push people forward on the housing waiting list.
It was the
Race and Housing Action Group for Tower Hamlets.
Race and Housing Action Group.
That's right.
And so this was a separate thing from Tower Hamlets Council?
It was a GLC advisory group which advised both our housing committee, on which I didn't serve because I had limited time off work, and the Ethnic Minorities Committee, which I did serve.
And it basically, you developed new methods for allocating housing or for doing consultation?
Yes, generally. I mean, we're talking now of over 30 years ago, so I can't remember every single detail, nor did I keep all the minutes of the meetings. But yes, generally I think that would be a fair resume of what we did and tried to do.
And so I've seen some publications that some of which we got from you and some I've seen elsewhere, which have been about housing allocation in Tower Hamlets.
Yes, indeed. There was a scandal about that, which was brought to our attention at council by a pressure group whose acronym was SHAPERS. I forget the full spelling out of that, SHAPERS. Obviously it was Spitalfields, in which people were denied housing or appropriate housing, and I think that was one of the spurs to setting this group up.
And what about the Ethnic Minorities Committee? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, indeed. It's probably best remembered now for its grant giving to local groups across London. People criticised us for throwing public money around. That is not true. We had, as well as the officer's report on the organisations, for every grant we gave, there was also a supplementary report from the finance department of the DLC, which was neutral, and the legal department. It was really good to see so much money going into organisations. That's what we're best remembered for, but there were other things as well. During the time of the election, of course, the troubles took place in Brixton, and during our period in County Hall, later again in Brixton, and of course in Tottenham, Broadwater Farm Estate, we had our own experts to look at this situation. And we agree with a lot of what Scarman said about racial disadvantage. But we were first to point out the problem of institutional racism as well in many organisations, not least the Metropolitan Police. And it was good to see 16, 17 years later that the McPherson Committee came to the same conclusion and that steps have been taken by the police since then in the last 18 years.
So when you say you've got experts in, what sort of things did those experts do?
They helped us write the papers to a large extent. We also had a subcommittee which, if my memory is right, was called the Anti-Racist Programme Subcommittee, which was a body representing various groups ranging from the British Council of Churches to the Institute for Race Relations and other groups. Bernie Grant, for example, was one member of that. I'm sure he's well known to most Londoners, remembered by them. And this group did feed in, like the Tower Hamlets group, a lot of useful insights and knowledge and helped us produce those publications which related to the situation of black and Asian people in London.
And what were the consequences of those reports?
Well, the consequences of the reports were that we became, I would say, the leading authority in looking in a new way at the whole situation of community relations in urban areas. And much of what we did stands to this day. There's an old story, isn't it, that what is once considered really way out is later considered the norm, and I believe that is the case today as we see so much change which has been made in the past 30 years.
So what, when you're saying that there was a new approach, what was the old approach and what was the new approach you were bringing in?
I can't speak with much authority of the old approach because I wasn't there. I think it was very much a process simply of saying, well, if you put enough money to a problem, or if you give enough people enough education, that will do. There's truth in both of those things, of course, but it was far more getting down in contact with the communities. It's a case question, really, of listening, analysing, and then acting on what you've heard and thought about.
So what sorts of things got acted upon that had not been acted upon before?
Well, obviously the housing allocation, that's when it comes immediately to mind. looking also at our employment policies, looking at where, for example, we advertise our jobs and our opportunities. The Voice was a newspaper, Afro-Caribbean newspaper, which I remember we used to advertise in quite extensively.
And what about the kind of workings of that committee? What do you remember about what were the meetings like?
They were very good humoured, and I'd like to put on record that the Conservative group and the solitary Liberal member of the GLC who was on the committee were entirely constructive throughout. I'm sure there are people in all political parties who were concerned about what was happening in London at the time. Some very, very gifted colleagues indeed. Ken, by choice, chaired it to show the importance of that committee. Paul Boateng, who later went on to become a cabinet minister and ambassador to South Africa, was our vice chair. Amongst the members was the chair of the staff committee, John Carr, who's gone on to do so much good work in child protection on the internet. We had people of extreme high quality indeed. And to their credit, the opposition also put forward some very high quality people to serve on the committee. It was a privilege to work with them.
And do you remember, you know, how often the committee would meet?
Yes, except for obviously the breaks for Christmas, Easter, and a lengthier one as a summer recess, all committees met every 3 weeks. In the afternoon.
And how long were those meetings?
It varied. Sometimes we'd have many reports, very detailed reports, lengthy discussions. We sometimes would invite members of groups to come and address us. So they were lengthy meetings, but they were most enjoyable to and informative to sit through. On the other hand, I remember one meeting when in half an hour we had given out £500,000 in grants.
So you were also making decisions about grants?
Yes, indeed. As I say, that's what we were probably taken to task for by certain newspapers at the time. But we stand by that, and many of the organisations, I can speak only of those in Waltham Forest, which for whom I and Paul obtained grants, are flourishing to this present day, and are remembered. We are remembered by people from those groups right to the present.
And you say sometimes people came in to address you.
Yes, indeed.
Do you remember any particular people that?
They were mainly representatives of the organisations who would sometimes come and address us. It's 30-odd years ago, so I can't remember exact names now.
And what do you think you're most proud of in your memories of the of that committee, the Ethnic Minorities Committee?
I think the sense of empowering, recognising and respecting different groups in London. 30 years back, there were different attitudes towards people from different groups, which seems to have broken down over the years. And I'd like to think the work we did played a large part in that. Certainly the way local authorities and other public bodies provide services and devise employment policies reflects the aspirations we had at the time.
And what about any kind of difficulties or things that you, looking back, you wish you'd done differently?
I think it's the old story of any elected member that you're there for 4 years. In the event it was five, of course, because of abolition, and we had the extra year added on. Sometimes you wish you had more time to educate people who were not racist but were concerned about what was going on. I think there was a genuine concern. Perhaps we were running when other people had yet to be taught how to walk.
And what was the relationship with the civil service within the GLC as other kind of officers and employees?
No, I was not a committee chair or a member of policy committee, so I can make no comment on that. I found the officers helpful, polite, and highly professional at all times.
And let's talk a bit about the Labour Party.
Yes.
So there's the Labour Party in your local area.
Yes.
There's the Labour group within the GLC.
Indeed.
And then there's obviously the National Labour Party.
And the regional party between the two.
And the regional party. So could you talk a bit about the relationships between these different parts of the Labour Party?
The local party I had good relationships with. I reported back every month to the General Committee, which is the governing body of the Leighton Labour Party, which had representatives from the different ward parties and some trade unions on it. I always gave a written report, which my PA would type up for me at County Hall. Yes, we still had typewriters then, and would then photocopy and give out at the meeting. So I believed in keeping contact with the party throughout, particularly when we were going to make controversial decisions. I took a full part in that party's life. I spoke to branch meetings when asked. I assisted in the 1983 general election in Leighton, and generally involved myself in the social life of the party as well. So the relationship there was good. The party particularly appreciated my links with the local press, and I ensured that everybody, party members or not, who took the local paper, as people did in those days, was able to see what I was doing and hear my views on what we were doing. As regards the regional party, the regional party did have representatives on the GLC group. Ted Knight, the leader of Lambeth Council, was one of them, and the other one was Arthur Latham, who had been the MP for Paddington, I think, until 79, and either was or was going to be the leader of Havering Council. So we had that link. As regards the link with the National Party did support us, particularly in the time of abolition, to my memory. There was a controversy within the group in February 1985. A minority of members wanted not to set a rate in form of protest. Had we done that, that would have been illegal. It could probably have cost us our homes in some cases because of surcharge. And in that time of turmoil, the National Party did send Larry Whitty along, who was then the General Secretary of the Labour Party. But again, I wasn't at the upper echelons of the group simply because I had a full-time job and a young family to support, so I wasn't privy to any behind-the-scenes discussions at regional or national level.
Can you, so the regional Labour group, what was that, what area was that?
It was coterminous with Greater London.
Okay. And can you, just because some people listening might not be familiar with the stuff around the rates, so what, when you say they didn't want to set a rate, what do you mean?
The rate, which is now of course the council tax, is the main form of income for any local authority, along with the government grants. And as a form of protest against abolition and other things, a minority of Labour members wanted to break the law, which I didn't, and Ken Livingstone didn't. So there was a split, which was short-lived. We met on the Thursday afternoon evening, and the meeting had to be adjourned in the early hours of Friday morning, after which, incidentally, I was teaching a few hours later. And we resumed, I believe, on the Sunday afternoon and we went into the Sunday evening. The Conservatives would vote against setting a rate, simply for tactical reasons, to show the split. But when the chief executive said, you've got to vote this time, implying you've got to vote what you really mean, it was surprising how they came across and voted with the Labour group.
And then voted to set a rate.
Yes, indeed. And in the event, when abolition followed 14 months later, we were still awash with money.
And so, can you explain a bit more as well about why your houses would have been up?
Yes, it was a system then called surcharge. Had a ratepayer, or more likely a Tory-controlled council, taken this to court, as they did over the Fares Fair decision a few years earlier, and won, which I think in all probability they would have done, we would have been personally liable for the money which was not collected. And so far as most members was concerned, your house would go.
I don't know if you have thoughts on this, but I've heard people talk about people taking inspiration from popularism and what happened in Poplar in the 1920s. Was that something that you remember being talked about?
I'm generally a great fan of George Lansbury, who was a wonderful Christian socialist, but that was in a different context in those days. It wouldn't have been a case of being put in prison, as happened in Poplar, as some form of protest, like a sit-down strike or something like that. The law had been changed so that the assets of ordinary members were at risk. People did not want to break the law. The law should be campaigned against. In many instances, we took legal advice on many of our decisions, particularly the Ethnic Minorities Committee, to go up to the limit of the law. And we did. But to cross that line, no.
And just for people to understand what... So I just mentioned the Poplar thing and people might not know that. So could you describe what you know of that?
Yes. It was in the 1920s. The council was led by a councillor called George Lansbury, who was a very prominent member of the Anglican Church, a great pacifist, who'd already resigned his parliamentary seat to show solidarity with the suffragettes and lost a by-election on that, I believe, in 1912. At that time, the richer boroughs were refusing to have their money raised to be transferred into the poorer boroughs in London, and of course Poplar in the East End was extremely poor at the time. And so the councillors did refuse to set a rate, and some of them were put in prison, including Lansbury himself. The government did, in the event, stand down, and they were released after a relatively short period of time. One thinks of the building workers almost exactly 50 years later, when they were released for breaking the Industrial Relations Act.
So you mentioned before about controversial decisions. So there was obviously the question of setting the rate.
Yes.
What other kind of controversial decisions did you feel that, for example, you needed to tell local people?
Yes. In the grants field, we were not only dealing with race relations in my own particular work, but we also had the Women's Committee, and we had a general grants committee as well. In some instances, you needed to persuade your colleagues in Waltham Forest that it was right to support feminist or homosexual groups. We took a lot of flak, particularly on the second one, both in the press and indeed, I'm ashamed to say, from people in the churches in Waltham Forest who otherwise were in general agreement with the stance we were taking on race relations and the peace movement, for example.
And so what kind of things did you try and do to persuade people?
Individually, I'd speak to them and I'd obviously take these issues up by letter, or in the case of the party, through the general committee, I would address these matters. But again, we seem to be quite a peaceful place in Waltham Forest, and there wasn't all that much criticism I received, at least to my face.
I'm going to go back a little bit again to the Transport Committee.
Yes, of course.
Could you describe a bit about the Fares Fair campaign? Because obviously it was a very big thing. Some people weren't coming to this project, weren't known.
This was the main issue for us in outer London. Fares in London were very expensive compared with other capital cities and indeed cities in this country. One thing we promised, and the thing I believe in outer London we promised, was to cut the fares by 25%. Those fares, of course, were the London Underground and the London Red Buses, then publicly owned. It did not affect the mainline rail services, all of which then were under British Rail. It was very popular. It was a thing which sold itself on the doorstep, because in outer London, particularly where there was no link with education as there was in inner London, it was the issue. And I'm sure the large number of people who turned out to vote and turned around the situation in Leighton, amongst other people, places, actually reflected that. So we were shocked when Bromley took us to court on this issue. We believed we'd acted legally. We also believed it was the main issue in the election, and particularly in outer London. It was genuinely popular. We also at the same time brought in the zonal fares, and we brought in what was then called the capital card, later called the travel card. We were taken to court by Bromley. It went through a series of courts in the way things do, to the Court of Appeal, and then to the Law Lords, notably and notoriously Lord Denning, who upheld what the Tory council wanted. They argued that there were no tube services in Bromley, and so they were paying more for getting less. We were maintained that we had the right to do this, and indeed when London Transport was transferred from being a nationalised industry to an arm's length body linked to the GLC, Margaret Thatcher, who was then the environment spokesperson in the House of Commons, said, but that means that if they have an election which goes a certain way, and she absolutely predicted what happened in 81 of all people. I think it was our first confrontation, and in the event we had to put up the fares, but a year later, again due to the legal expertise we were able to buy in, we were able to reduce the fares. But the principles we brought in of Fares Pair still stand today, if only the level of fares had remained the same.
You talked a bit about equal opportunities.
Yes.
Could you describe a bit more about how the GLC was trying to achieve equality or equal opportunities?
Within our own institution, we looked to widening our staff base, and this was achieved through advertising in appropriate channels, by looking at our own staffing policies under John Carr. In the provision of services, we wanted to ensure that all needs were covered as far as that is possible, and we did our best to work in that direction. In our arts programme, which was under the chairpersonship of Tony Banks, we broadened out the organisations to which we gave grants. We set up a special unit on race relations in the GLC. We had our own officers who advised the Ethnic Minorities Committee, and they were representative of the groups in London, as well, of course, as being fully qualified in their own right. And I suppose the name which was outstanding of all was, of course, Herman Ouseley, who later went on to head the Community Relations Commission, as I think it was called at the time, and now is a member of the House of Lords in his own right.
And how successful do you think those policies were, those structures were?
I think they are, because today we take filling in a form asking your ethnic origins, your gender, as just part of the normal procedure, particularly in public or bodies, but I think more generally. I think the attitudes have changed. There are still people who need to change. There are still areas where further change would be desirable. But compared with the late 60s to late 80s, as I knew London then, and the London I've known from the 90s to date, yes, there has been a change. And I think that we took a pioneering part in that work of generally of equal opportunities.
And what about the kind of celebrations or the festivals? Did you go to the festivals?
Oh, yes, very much so. Thames Day was really fantastic. That was great. Which had everything going on along the south bank of the Thames near County Hall. Various rock groups playing as well, including those from the 60s, who I could remember, and no doubt my fellow members at the time. And fantastic firework display in the evening. Yes, those things were very much remembered and appreciated. We also did events tied into different years. We had a peace year, which I think was 86, and we had a year to celebrate London against racism, and that was an extra celebrations with those. That was really good.
Do you remember any particular bands or performers that you saw that you liked?
No, I do remember seeing various 60s groups, but not my own particular favourites, because I was into soul and R&B more than pop at the time. But Jerry and the Pacemakers, I believe, played once. I remember the Tremolos played in the Queen Elizabeth Hall. I can't remember the others, but I'm sure they were there.
And tell me about Thames Day. Was that a one-off? It happened every year?
It was. That was every year. I cannot remember whether we initiated it or whether, like the saying, GLC working for London, it was inherited by our predecessors, from our predecessors.
And what did the festivals feel like?
It's good to see so many people in the summer in London enjoying themselves, coming from all over London, and I suspect beyond as well. And of course, that has now continued. Now we have the Mayor of London with the various firework displays to this day.
And so is this a contrast with the GLC from before 1980?
As I say, I don't know. In outer London, we tend to keep ourselves a bit to ourselves, unless we go into central London to work, shop, or go to the theatre.
So thinking a bit about what it was like working within the GLC, how did people get on with each other at work or outside of work?
At County Hall. Yes, I found the relationship was very professional. People have drawn obvious comparisons with Parliament. There are excellent facilities for members, a restaurant overlooking the Thames with a terrace and a bar attached to it. The relationships between individual people were generally cordial across the parties. It was almost like a club atmosphere. It doesn't mean that because you're nice to people, as you should be, I believe, doesn't mean that you can still strongly disagree with them and make that public. But at the personal relationship, it was a very civilised place to be.
And did you make friends there?
Yes, indeed I did. Some of whom I'm in contact with to this day, but many of whom, indeed, some younger than myself, have died.
And would you say that a community formed?
Very much so, yes. I think that probably was always there, because I only did the one term of office, which in the event was the final term of office for everybody. But I think it did have a history of being like the place on the opposite bank of the Thames.
And what did your friends and family think about you being a member of the GLC?
Totally supportive. And one of the good things about County Hall was that these facilities were open around the year, bar bank holidays, and so I was able to bring up my two young children and my wife to lunch when we're in London, which they enjoyed, and looking at the boats on the Thames. And my wife, after getting babysitters, would often come up for the evening meetings of County Hall on the Tuesdays, and we were able to invite someone along for a meal as well, usually someone linked with the Labour Party in the borough, and of course our friends as well. My parents were both alive then, very much alive, and my father was also pleased, and mother was also pleased to come up to County Hall and to meet people and find out you don't believe everything you read about them in the Daily Mail. Well, we were considered extremists. They used the phrase on one occasion of the most odious people in the country, and generally took a very hardline right-wing populist stance against the things we were doing. Their main line, as other critics were at the time, was one of ridicule.
And what influence do you think that had on the general public in London and outside London?
I would have said surprisingly little, because I think the message got across that by removing local democracy, you're removing the influence people can have through their representatives and removing some of the identity of London itself. So it's come as no surprise that there is a consensus, that there is a need for London-wide government, which we've had from the time of the Blair government to the present day.
And were there were kind of negative views about the GLC coming from the Daily Mail and the right-wing press, but were there other negative views about the GLC that you encountered from left-wing organisations?
Well, there are always going to be people who say you're not left-wing enough, but we're concerned with practical policies, practical politics, and some people would never fully agree with what you're doing because they have their own strongly held ideological beliefs.
And what about the relationship between the GLC and other councils within London, particularly the kind of radical ones?
The relationships with Labour councils were generally good at that time. Our main critics were Westminster. Lady Porter was out to get us, and look where she ended up, involved in the sky. Well, she ended up involved in the scandal herself about manipulating housing to enhance the Tory vote in Westminster, and had to flee the country, I believe, to Israel.
And what about the so kind of practical relationships between local councils and the GLC?
Again, I wasn't involved at that higher level, but my experience in Waltham Forest was that they were supportive of what we were doing. We in turn recognised that day-to-day management of housing was better left to the borough level, where they're in contact with local people.
And thinking more internationally, what was happening internationally during that period, and how did that relate to what was happening at the GLC?
It was a time, of course, of the Falklands War. It was a time of an intensification of the Cold War. Greenham Common, the planting of the American missiles there. And in fact, the GLC, the Labour Group, was very much involved in the peace movement. We had a peace year. We raised awareness of the dangers of nuclear winter. I remember that. And we also did provide some facilities for a group called Women for Peace on Earth, who had a conference, because we were all asked, would you mind if people use your offices over the weekend? Which I said, of course not, well done.
And what was the kind of processes and practices? Do you know kind of what inspired them? Do you know if people were looking at models from elsewhere about how city government could work?
We certainly adopted things and expanded things which had been started elsewhere. I believe that Lambeth Borough Council was the first to have an explicitly ethnic minorities council, and of course South Yorkshire Metropolitan County Council, which was continuously Labour controlled from 74, had pioneered the low fares policy. And so we were able to adopt, extend and improve what had been started elsewhere in this country. But I can't answer any international comparisons, except we would quote the level of fares in other capital cities compared with our own to make our case.
And so thinking about, specifically about abolition.
Yes.
What are your memories of that period?
It was quite a long period, because it came out of the blue in 1983 during the course of the general election. It wasn't expected. We could have foreseen something because of the dispute over the fares policy. The Conservatives were split in Parliament. There were those who saw the need for a London-wide authority, because remember, it was Macmillan's Conservative government in its London Government Act of 1963 which had set up the system of the GLC and the London boroughs. And then the Heath government in the 1972 Local Government Act, which had set up a similar arrangement of metropolitan county councils and metropolitan boroughs in the West Midlands and parts of the north of England. The Tories on the GLC were mainly against abolition and lobbied their own party very hard, and it's to their credit that we should remember them. There were various resolutions passed through the full council meeting of the Tuesday evening. The Tories themselves had set up, and they will give you details no doubt of this, their own lobbying regarding the government. It came as a great shock when it finally happened. Four members, three Labour, one Tory, stood down in May 85 on grounds of principle, saying we were only elected for 4 years as a protest. In the event, two Labour seats and one Tory was held, but one seat was lost by Labour to the Social Democrats. It was London's loss greater than our loss. We didn't have a direct voice, and the 32 boroughs could not speak with the same authority as one elected body with specific roles to do regarding London's transport planning, arts and various other things for which we held responsibility.
So can you tell me about that kind of last few months of the GLC?
Well, the last few months were really making sure that our legacy would continue, giving out what grants we could to organisations, ensuring that certain services were preserved. I can't remember offhand which ones. We did argue, our colleagues in Inner London did argue for a directly elected Inner London Education Authority. That did happen, but it only lasted for one session from 86 to 90. We wanted to go out on a high note, so we had a final meeting of the council that was also linked with, again, with one of the festivals you've mentioned, and the general attitude was, we'll be back. Well, it did take a good 10 years or more, but of course, in the beginning of the 21st century, London has a directly elected mayor and a directly elected assembly, which is supplemented under the proportional representation of minor parties as well. So the case for London government, we were right, and it has been proven.
And so, thinking about the impact of being involved in the GLC,
yes,
personally, how did it impact on you and your life?
Oh, very much so. It's one of the highlights of my life, along with my university education and of all the things outside of my family, which has been very happy in its own right. I'd say it's the thing I most remembered and possibly may even be remembered for. It was like having another university education. You had all the atmosphere, you had all this learning about London and all this ability to actually change things for the better, and I think we did a good job. Had we been working with a Labour government, I think it would be an even better story. But people voted in 79 the way they did, and I'm sure many people by now have analysed why they voted in that way.
And how has that experience shaped what happened afterwards, what you did with your life afterwards?
During the course of the election, of the GLC's life, when I entered it, I was the national vice chair of the Christian Socialist Movement. In 1980, I became their chair on a voluntary basis and remained so for the next 10 years, which involved me meeting very interesting people, going to interesting places, and getting the Christian Socialist Movement, which now styles itself, I believe, Christians on the Left, to affiliate to the Labour Party in 1988. And I remember going with our General Secretary, Elizabeth Hogg, and Lord Soper to hand over the cheque in the Labour Party headquarters, which were then in Walworth Road. I became very involved as a school governor, and I also continued in education until I took voluntary redundancy when our sixth form college lost a lot of money in the late 90s. I did suffer cardiac arrest the following year, and so I've not been able to return to full-time work, but I'm now very active in the community as a school governor, as a magistrate for over 14 years, and indeed for the last 8 years I've been on the body which interviews people who wish to be magistrates for all the courts in North and East London. So I've been involved in the community. And yes, I'm still taking church services for every quarter.
How do you think the GLC of that time impacted on London's community?
Oh, very much, very much. As I say, the legacy is around us. As I drove here as I came on the train here this morning to be interviewed by you, Debs, the train is still in zone 4. I'm now of an age where I can actually enjoy the freedom pass. I voted for others in the 1980s, so that's two things. We drove over Walthamstow marshes, alive with wildlife and people walking around, not gravel pits. When I got off the train at Hackney Downs, there's a plaque there celebrating the work the GLC committee did in the name of Dave Wetzel, which brought back many memories. And as I've already said at some length, no doubt, the impact we've made not only on transport, on the environment and on ethnic relations have remained and grown. But what was considered once controversial is now considered the normal. And I think that is the success of anything. Look, for example, the controversy when I was in my pram about bringing in the National Health Service, and how only this morning the Conservative Secretary of State said the National Health Service is one of this country's greatest achievements. That, I think, speaks for itself, and speaks for itself for the GLC achievements as well.
And what do you think that, you kind of talking about the successes of the GLC, can you think of any kind of general failures of the GLC at that time?
As I've said already, I think at times we expected to run when people had not fully yet learnt how to walk. I think looking back, but it's so difficult to speculate, is not what someone who's trained as a historian should ever do. But I think that we could have handled the relationships with government in a different way. But I wasn't there in that position high enough to influence that.
And what do you think would have happened if the GLC hadn't been abolished?
We would have had low fares to start with, and consistently, and we would have had direct representation in those missing years from 86 to the early 20s.
And why do you think that this history has been forgotten or is not so well known?
It's difficult to say whether it has been forgotten. I think for those of us who were around at the time and involved in the time, it has been remembered. But of course, younger generations have come along to whom Margaret Thatcher is as much history as Winston Churchill or David Lloyd George. So I think the story needs to be told, and it needs to be looked at objectively. I don't think history teaches us any lessons. It would be heretical of me to say that, this is when I originally came to London to study history. But I do think that people can find some common threads between the problems of the 21st century and those of the 1980s.
And what can we learn from the GLC that's relevant today, do you think?
I think one thing which struck me both at constituency level and working with the Tower Hamlets Race and Housing Action Group is the importance of people who are making decisions to actually go to and listen to the people who will be affected by those decisions, because they have an expertise which is as valuable as the expertise of professional experts.
Great. And is there anything else that you would like to just raise or mention or remember about your time at the GLC in the 1980s?
I'd like to thank the people of Leighton who actually elected me, the party members who supported me, and above all my wife Janet, who supported me throughout this period and didn't mind me going off to all these meetings and filling a house with all the committee papers.